Today, 2019, a year in review. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest posts covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. On the last day of the year, I wanted to highlight some of the key issues which have emerged and also tell you about this channel's performance through the year. The stock markets have performed better than expected, thanks to the about-face that we've seen from central banks, who have been busily cutting rates in an attempt to stimulate growth. And by the way, growth, of course, has been slowing. Despite some profit taking, which is occurring at the end of the year, as I record this show, the Dow Jones is up 22.01% over the year, the Nasdaq is up 34.8%, the Shanghai Composite up 21.9%, the FTSE up 12.77%, and locally the ASX 100 is up 20.99%. Now, these returns, of course, are flattered because at the end of last year, the markets were well down, as back then expectations were for interest rates to rise, as flagged then, for example, by both the Federal Reserve and the RBA. Both said one thing, but actually did the opposite. So lesson one this year is you cannot believe central bankers. Volatility indices have also fallen over the year, with the CBOE Volatility Index down 41.8% and the Australian VIX down 38.3%. But again, these are flattered by high levels of uncertainty a year back, and the three-year indices are up 5.51% for the CBOE VIX, but down 13.17% for the Aussie VIX. So lesson two, the period over which you look at trends matters. The US interest rates are a lot lower, with the 30-year Treasury down 22.58% over the year, the 10-year down 29.75%, and the 3-month down 35.2%. The German 30-year bond is down 61.23%, and the 10-year is down a massive 178.46%. And central bank rates are also down, with the RBA taking rates to a painfully low 0.75%, despite a few years ago declaring that 3% was an emergency level. And rates are, of course, negative in the Eurozone and Japan. So lesson three is that low, ever lower rates are a reaction to slowing growth, but the truth is that this simplistic approach to stimulating growth is plain broken. Among commodities, gold was up 15.6% over the year, silver was up 13.77%, and WTI crude oil was up 35.7% over the past 12 months. And Bitcoin was up 90.3% over 12 months and 654% over 3 years. Finally, the financial sector saw the S&P financials up 29.3%, the FTSE financials was up 28.5%, while the ASX 200 financials was up 8.85%. Many US financial firms did well. For example, Goldman Sachs was up 37.48%, and elsewhere the Royal Bank of Scotland was up 11.6%, while locally CBA was up 12%, NAB was up 3.4%, ANZ up 1.4%, and Westpac was down 2.6%. The Bank of Queensland was down 23.9% and Macquarie was up 28%. So, lesson four, are major banks underperformed? No surprise, given the ongoing disclosures, poor behaviour, and the loss of several CEOs. Indeed, ANZ's Shayne Elliott is literally the last man standing. Yet the broader economic news is pretty grim. Global debt continued to rise, as the recent World Bank Global Waves of Debt report showed, to around 250% of GDP, and this is driven by central banks expanding their balance sheets through QE in many places, governments running bigger deficits, and businesses and households being encouraged to take on ever more debt, facilitated, of course, by lower interest rates. But remember that debt has to be repaid eventually, and the World Bank warned that such a fast-rising global debt could lead directly to the next financial crisis. 31% of the debt resides in the USA, 17% in Japan, 9.8% in China, and 3.9% in France, while Germany and the UK both have 3.5%, and in Australia, ours is at 0.8%. Japan has a debt-to-GDP ratio of 237%, with 90% held domestically, while Australia has more than $1 trillion of overseas net debt, debt owing to the rest of the world. And that's a record. And of course, the Fed continues its non-QE QE program through the repo markets as it tries to shore up liquidity in the financial system. After a period of balance sheet reduction, they are now expanding again to over $4 trillion US dollars. And interest rates are at unprecedented low levels, as this long-term chart from Visual Capitalist highlights. And remember, the IMF said that a cut of 4 to 5% would be needed to recover from a GFC-type crisis with rates so low, that is impossible without deeply negative rates. Ultimately, the aim of the central bank is to increase economic activity and spur inflation from the low or even deflationary levels that some countries are currently in danger of. And there are at least four ways that this can happen. First, banks can lend more to households and companies rather than holding on to cash, which would now become more costly. Secondly, businesses can invest more as funding investment is now cheaper. Third, households could save less or borrow to spend more. And demand for the currency could fall, which might lead to a depreciation of the currency, an increase in the price of imported goods, and growing demand for the country's now cheaper exports. But in practice, banks are not lending more, preferring to speculate on derivatives and bonds, and households are unwilling to borrow more, despite the pressure on savers, who must either pay to hold their deposits in the banks or to invest their funds at higher risks elsewhere. We think the negative rate experiment is failing. As a recent paper from some Eurozone bankers said, in summary, how do negative interest rates work? The answer is badly. In Australia, the MIEFO included the surprising news that real spending per person is expected to go backwards over the next 4 years. This compares with a long-run average of 1.8% growth. So the government is tightening the screws to try to deliver its iconic surplus, but at what cost? And once again, the Treasury has downgraded its outlook for future wages growth. Frankly, the track record of both Treasury and the RBA on wages forecasting has been abysmal. And remember that Treasury is still hoping to see wages growth kick up if unemployment falls below 5%, while the Reserve Bank contends it needs to fall to 4.5% for an impact on wages growth. Yet currently, unemployment is above 5% and the forward indicator suggests more weakness ahead. So, wages will be lower for longer. And by the way, this is true of many Western economies, not just ours. Just how serious this is was shown in this recent OECD data, with real disposable income per capita in Australia going backwards over the period 2014 to 2019 and well behind the OECD average. One key reason is the high population growth from migration, with more than 220,000 arriving, well above homegrown natural growth of around 150,000. As well as putting a cap on wages, many assume this will also support home prices through greater demand, except around 220,000 new residential units are still being built each year, and migrants often come as a family group, so the number of homes required is a lot lower than the migration count. Confidence levels of households continues to fall, and even the good time to buy a house measure is now easing back, having spiked after the surprise election result back in May. We also see that Australia leads on household debt servicing ratios at 15.6, compared with Canada at 13.3 and around double the UK and US averages. And we are second at 119.3 after Switzerland at 130.9 in terms of household debt to GDP, both bad news for households. And this is one reason why the momentum for new credit is easing back now. Business confidence is also down, with retail recoiling from weaker consumer spending and construction way down. We've seen a number of high-profile store closures this year, and I think more will come next year. The residential building approvals and dwelling investment growth rates are also well down, and new vehicle sales are also falling. The last best hope from both Treasury and the RBA is that households will start spending again and that rising home prices will be the trigger. No surprise then that any positive news on home price rises are trotted out despite low volumes and other indices not telling the same story. This is propaganda, trying to talk the market and household spending higher. And by the way, anyone caught questioning the numbers are called terrorists by people who should know better. APRA peddled this mythology in their report justifying the maintenance of the zero countercyclical capital buffer by annualising the 3-month rises in home prices to make Sydney and Melbourne look like they rose more than 20%. This is rubbish. Sure, some price rises are there in more expensive suburbs, and they are mainly houses, but the bulk of the market and unit prices in particular are still languishing. The latest CoreLogic Daily Index continues to tick higher, even through the holiday period where sales are sparse, to say the least. Perhaps they should explain why this is the case. But prices are still down from previous peaks. Actually, the economy is totally reliant on income from our exports of iron ore and coal in particular, and significant government spending on infrastructure. But GDP will remain weaker for longer because the household and business sectors are under such pressure. And the fires and drought will continue to hit growth ahead. More seriously, GDP is a very poor measure of anything useful. It rewards activity, whatever. It fails to account for or represent the degree of income inequality in society. It fails to indicate whether the nation's rate of growth is sustainable or not. And it fails to account for the costs imposed on human health and the environment of negative externalities arising from the production or consumption of the nation's output. And in addition, it effectively treats the replacement of depreciated capital the same as the creation of new capital, and it excludes non-market transactions. More growth is not better. It's time for a new framework which looks at human well-being, not just economic outcomes, not least because we live on a finite planet and cannot continue to consume in such an unsustainable way. GDP has the benefit of being simple, but it is also plain wrong and measures success or failure on the wrong basis. I'll have a lot more to say about this next year. But before I finish my summary of the year, we should celebrate the fact that we managed to post at least once every day through the year. This was my objective, you may recall. And importantly, we wanted to ensure the quality and variety of our posts did not diminish. Well, judging by the lift in views of more than 5.2 million compared with last year, that's up 154%, I think we succeeded. And I want to thank you for watching our shows and supporting our work. We could not have done it without you. There were some shows that really got attention through the year, and I thought I would take you through the top shows by views. In 12th place, with 24,600 views, was my discussion back in February on home prices, where we discussed the metrics and what drives them. Through the year, we became more and more uncomfortable with the way the mainstream media reported the movements. In 11th place, with 25,100 views, was my show from October on low interest rates and what they're doing to the banks. All the research suggests that banks will lend less and take more risks to support shareholder returns, which is not what central banks are after. In 10th place, with 27,500 views, was the first of two shows with Harry Dent, the economist and author, who believes there will be a significant market correction still to come. The March show centered on the live Q&A session, which was well attended. In 9th place, with 28,400 views, was my show in May on Deutsche Bank, as its share price continued to slide back then. The recent sell-offs from its investment banking division and staff cuts are all about trying to turn this G-SIB around, but there is still very much to do. In 8th place, with 29,000 views, was my discussion on deposit bail-in from September. This risk remains, and frankly, it was a sneaky strategy slipped into legislation a couple of years ago. Bail-in of deposits is real and may hit us down the track. Savers, beware. In 7th place, with 30,600 views, was a post relating to my ABC Four Corners appearance back in 2017, where we looked at mortgage stress and identified, for example, Mandurah in Western Australia and new developments in Western Sydney as risk areas. And it also shone a spotlight pre-Royal Commission on bank behaviour, and frankly, little has changed since, except home prices, which are now up to 30% lower in the West. In sixth place, with 35,100 views, is the first of three shows on the cash ban. In August, momentum really started to turn as more woke up to the loss of civil liberty this draft legislation implies. In fifth place, with 36,600 views, was one of my three shows with Steve Keen, who visited us in July. In this show, we discussed how much debt was too much and what the RBA was likely to do. And his show on the link between economics and the environment, whilst not top ranking, was for me a very significant show too. In fourth place, with 38,900 views, the second of three shows in the list relating to the cash ban. This has been a major focus this year as the Treasury tried to sneak this legislation through late on a Friday night. But we called this out as a serious and concerning development and linked it to monetary policy and negative interest rates. In third place, with 86,600 views, was my second discussion this year with Harry Dent when he came here in October. More of the same discussion about the coming market correction, but with a focus on Australia too. And our second most popular post of the year, with 87,600 views, was my discussion with Lynette Zhang, who outlined her analysis of the coming financial crisis and what strategies might be considered to alleviate the fallout. But our most watched show of 2019 was the real issues behind the cash ban. Here, Robbie Barwick and I took the draft legislation apart and highlighted the true agenda. That received 152,150 views and is still a record. And by the way, just to complete the picture, on the Interest of the People channel with John Adams, the top show this year with 111,460 views was our post, Australia's Debt Bubble is Falling Apart. The size of the debt in Australia continues to grow and remains a significant economic risk. And so in closing the year, many of the key risks remain active, and in a future post, I will discuss my thoughts relating to 2020, including the trajectory of home prices ahead. More broadly, we will continue to keep a watch on our civil liberties, the behaviour of our banks and regulators, and the broader economic issues which we will face. Thanks for your support of our work through the year. Do subscribe if you haven't already done so, and ring the bell for future alerts. We plan to continue to post daily in 2020, by the way. Also, I want to thank those who contacted me directly via the DFA blog. The link is below. I always read your comments on the channel and those sent direct. I'm particularly appreciative of suggestions for topics to explore or guests to invite on the channel. Keep both coming. And a request, please keep your comments on the channel polite and respectful. I've noted and moderated away some more troubling, nay racist, comments recently. They are not appropriate and will be removed. The DFA community is a great community and I want to ensure it remains that way. But for now, I wish you and yours a safe and peaceful new year, and keep watching our channel for more great content coming soon. And links to all the shows are in the comments below. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.